Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast, a podcast all about women and the arts, hosted by Stani and Sadie.
Join us as we explore what it's like being a female artist, examine modern day problems, and educate ourselves and you on important and forgotten female artists of the past.
Hello, welcome back to More Than Amused Podcast. My name is Sadie.
I'm Stani, and happy March Madness.
Happy March Madness.
We've been giving you double episodes every week, so hopefully you're feeling it along with all of us. It's definitely been a crazy month.
Yeah, absolutely. It's felt maddening, truly.
I know. I've been like, we meant March Madness as in let's get empowered and fired up, not let's have everything in my life go crazy all month long.
Let's not actually be madness. Yeah. Hold on. Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Mm-hmm. But you know what? We're figuring it out. And yeah. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be talking about what we're talking about today.
Same. I feel like this is funny because it's like the most researched I've ever been. And yet, mm-hmm. I don't know, I still felt like there was so much more that I was missing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, so this is literally going to be like the tiniest little slice of what we could have dove in with this topic. And I feel like that with everything we've talked about this month. And I'm like, here's a tiny portion of the entire picture.
I don't want to spend too much time here because mm-hmm. I know you have a lot that we want to go over. I did go to Olivia Rodrigo, though, last weekend.
Tell me everything, because you also saw Chapel Roan.
And I was just
so jealous
to say that I did see Chapel Roan mm-hmm. open for Olivia Rodrigo, and it was so good. We were in the tip top of the arena. Yeah. So they were little ants mm-hmm. and Chapel Roan was a blue sparkly little ant in a cowgirl hat. And I loved it. She did such a good job. The vocals were giving, as of course they would. Yes. Like, I knew they would. And it made me just want to go to a Chapel Roan show because, mm-hmm. like, I would love to see what her full production and what her whole show would look like. She was a perfect opener. And then Olivia was so much fun. It was so much fun. She was so good. That. I almost forgot how many ballads she has because, like, when she played her whole discography, I was like, oh, my gosh, it's another ballad. But it was – they're all so good.
Yeah, and she does have a lot of ballads, which is funny because I feel like everyone associates her with punk rock. But then, like,
now, yes.
She's singing these beautiful ballads.
That was, like, just the last section of the show is she mm-hmm. did, like, her more punk rock stuff. But she, like, was able to do the ballads, like, a little bit differently. And it was just a really good show. She sang every single song in her discography.
Wow.
Except for One Step Forward, Three Steps Back, and Hope You're Okay. But other than that, like, every song was in the set list.
I'm so jealous.
It's really cool. She's a great performer.
I was like, I did not get tickets for Olivia in Salt Lake City, which was already a bummer, but mm-hmm. Chapel Roan wasn't attached to that, so it made me feel like a little bit better. Because I was like, I'm not missing both of them. But
and then she did also have Sheryl Crow come out and sing If It Makes You Happy with her. That was a cool little moment from Nashville. It was really fun.
I love that. Our rising stars. Look at them go.
Our rising stars. We did a whole episode about Sour when it came out.
And I stand by
Olivia
that.
Fans. I do stand by that. I think we made very good points in that episode.
And of course, if you listened to anything from last year, we talked about Chapel Roan's album, The Rise and Fall of a Midwest Princess, a lot.
That was our favorites album of last year.
Yes.
So.
And in solidarity, because I knew you were going to be at the concert, I listened to that album all day that day.
There we go.
Yep. So I was like, I'm just going to pretend that I'm there.
It was so good. It was such a good show. I mean, you probably see the clips on TikTok, but.
Yeah, but
so
still.
Charismatic and so much more engaging. I don't know. She really, like, stage presence. It was there. The one thing that I thought was funny is I feel like the way she talks to the audience is still reminiscent of a Disney Channel star.
Oh, really?
It was so cute. I was just like, oh, guys, did you know? And it was so cute. Like,
that's cute.
It was giving Disney kid, but she's literally only 21.
I saw some headlines that people were getting, like, really annoyed by the fact that she's wearing more skimpy outfits on stage because she's 21 now. And I was like, okay, they're treating it like the Disney Kid Rebellion. And I'm like, it's not like she's ever been super clean.
Exactly. That's the one thing that I've also wondered. It's her very first single ever. It was explicit. Yeah, she's kid adjacent, but she's made it very clear that she's not for kids since day one.
Yes. I don't know. That's what was weird to me. And it's not like she's been dressing like super modestly either. And then all of a sudden was like, it's not a huge dramatic switch. It's like some slight things to be like, oh yeah, I'm older now. I feel more comfortable
doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a weird article.
I mean, I obviously wasn't offended by anything that was happening, but it was a great show. It honestly made me more of an Olivia fan, which was, I think, the goal of any concert. I was like, oh, man, I need to go back and listen to Guts.
So nice. One other thing that's funny. Have you been following the Kate Middleton drama?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I have indeed been following. And you know what's so crazy is that this episode is coming out on Friday. We're recording this on a Wednesday right now. Wow. Can you tell how on top of it we are? Yeah. Whatever. Side note. I'm just like, what else is going to happen in the next 2 days?
I know, right? That's what I've been thinking. I also think it's really funny. One thing I wanted to clarify for people who don't do a lot of photo editing is that everyone keeps saying that it's bad AI edits. None of the edits in those are AI. These are not AI generated people. The edits are not done with AI. This is bad Photoshop clone stamping. Like, that is what's taking place. I don't know what she was trying to fix, but literally I could do that bad. Like, I could show you what she's trying to do with a clone stamp in Photoshop in 2 seconds. Like, every single designer who's looked at it has been like, bad clone stamp. Right
there. Like, and the fact that they try to pass it off as, oh, she's just like picking up a casual Photoshop hobby is...
It was like, after trying to recover from an abdominal surgery, and she's just, let's sit on my computer and do some casual Photoshop as the Princess of Wales. I don't know. It feels a little outlandish.
Yeah, it's actually insane. And I feel like for the first couple of days that it was happening, I just saw people talking about it. And I was like, this isn't anything. Yeah. And then when the picture dropped and I heard people talking about Photoshop and I looked at it for one moment, and I don't have an eye for photography, I could instantly tell. Ever since that moment, I have been sucked in.
Yep. It's too much. I watched like a video on TikTok, so it could be completely fake, yesterday. But it was like talking about the fact that no one visited her in the hospital, and that like friends and family of the royals were very surprised, even though the official record said that it was like a planned surgery. And that her husband didn't go and visit the king when he was in the hospital because Kate was also there. And then they have one blurry photo of her in a car, and it's from like the back of her head. And then they showed like another picture where it's the same, and it was like, what is going on?
Where is she?
Yeah. I was like, are they really faking all of this? Because that would be so weird.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. But stay tuned, because like I said, in 2 days when this episode comes out, there might be new things to the saga, but I'm fully invested.
100%. The funniest thing too, I saw someone, they took the photo of Kate and her kids, and then they put it inside the Glasgow Willy Wonka experience image.
The world's colliding. I love the internet,
and
honestly.
They were like, imagine trying to explain this to someone who's not on the internet. And I was like, how would you? Like, how could you possibly? Oh my gosh.
There's literally no way. Anything else we need to touch on, or should we?
I don't think so. I think we can dive right in.
I'm excited. The Oscars happened, and I don't want to touch too much on it just because we could probably spend another 10 minutes. Emma Stone's acceptance speech was very sweet.
I still need to watch that, but I love her. You should watch it.
Yes, yeah. I love her too. I was surprised she won. I think she also was very surprised that she won. I was personally rooting for Lily Gladstone and think that she would have been awesome if she could have won. But I will say that Emma Stone's speech was very sweet and very charming.
Yes. So
you should go watch it.
I will say that I wasn't happy that Oppenheimer swept. But
yeah.
I'm not saying that it belonged to Barbie, but it wasn't I don't feel like that's the one that it should have gone to. But whatever.
Whatever. There were some fun moments. The I'm Just Ken performance. I got my crush on Ryan Gosling is back in full swing. I mean.
As it should be.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like more publicly present than he has been in a long time.
I know.
Recently too, which has been really fun.
I know.
Okay. Should we dive in?
Yes. Let's do it.
Okay. Basically, what we are going to do today is we talked to Hall at the beginning this week. mm-hmm. about an overview of her feelings about the art world and feminine rage. Today, I'm going to be diving specifically into a few pieces of art and then some movies that kind of encapsulate. I had the absolute hardest time narrowing down this list. It's mm-hmm. still probably too long. Well, it was so hard. So I'm not saying that these are the end all be all perfect pillars of this. These are mm-hmm. just the ones that I felt like resonated with me the most.
Yeah, totally.
Especially with the movies, like how on earth do you create? There's so many. And then another thing is that I was trying to figure out like a good way to group them because mm-hmm. I didn't want to just do it by year. And I've been making like this master list of every concept and everything with feminine rage, and it has different subcategories. And so I put these within those subcategories. So I hope that'll kind of help.
Yeah.
With that. And some of them are the same for the movie ones as well. And then there's some different ones because there's some topics that are touched on more in art than in movies and vice versa.
Totally.
Anyway, is that enough disclaimers?
Go for it. I'm ready.
Cool. So the first one is actually, it came up a lot. And the first like subcategory or like tenet of feminine rage that I'm going to talk about is mental health, which I feel like is a really important one, especially with female mental health and different things. Mm-hmm. If you've read The Feminine Mystique, they talk a lot about how the housewife and the different things that happened with women in the 1950s and 60s and how putting women in a box, a domestic mm-hmm. one or otherwise, is very detrimental and would be to anyone. And so mental health is the first part of feminine rage. But what was cool is there's actually this piece by Frida Kahlo called The Broken Column from 1944. And this is like a very incredible piece. One thing that annoys me, I could not find like a single image that didn't censor her boobs.
What?
Yes. Even this one, they wrote like the copyright over the top of it. I couldn't find a single one. People were putting like giant black boxes over it. Guys, boobs in art does not equal porn. Just the same thing as the David statue. He's fully nude. We don't. Yeah. It's not the same. Anyway, it's so frustrating. So it's like, she has boobs. It's not that crazy.
It's okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were all censored. So good luck finding one that's not. But basically what had happened is during her life, she had this really intense injury and had to stay in bed rest for like months. Mm. And during that time, it was also like really turbulent with her personal relationship and marriage with Diego Rivera. So there was like a lot going on there. And so not only was she feeling like her own physical limitations, but also a lot of society's expectations around her and everything. We talked mm-hmm. about how there used to be like newspaper articles that would say Diego Rivera's wife also dabbles in painting.
Yep.
And how like Frida Kahlo is way more famous than he is now. But
yes,
I feel like he's more of a footnote in her story now than vice versa. But this was one of those paintings that she used to express that time where it has her and then she has a broken column that's replacing her spine, like a Grecian column. And it's broken though. So it's showing like the center of herself has dealt with like physical suffering, emotional pain. And then there's also nails embedded in her face and body. And then it's in this like barren landscape. And so it's just showing like isolation, anguish, like rage, resilience, physical limitations, and mm-hmm. like societal expectations. So there's a lot going on there. And I feel like it's a really profound image, especially with her being so injured and broken and then still standing really strong. Mm-hmm. So that was a good one. And then this one I actually think is hilarious. This is Martha Rosler's Semiotics of the Kitchen from 1975. It's a short parody film, like very short. But what she's doing is she's like taking on the role of an apron-clad housewife. And then okay. she's parodying like a Julia Child's cooking demonstrations, which were really popular. And we've done an episode on Julia Child.
Yeah, we've talked about that.
So she's standing in the kitchen. She has like the full kitchen setup. There's a refrigerator, a table, a stove. And then she moves through the alphabet from A to Z and like assigns letters to various things.
Incredible. So
I can't remember exactly what it is, but she's A, apple. And then B, bread. Like mm-hmm. very like elementary education
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the idea behind it is that slowly then she gets more and more violent, where she like says rolling pin and then starts smashing stuff and then like knife and starts stabbing things. And it's showing the idea that like women in those roles were being like forced into a role way lesser than their education or their knowledge. And that there was like a certain rage that they couldn't really express because it wasn't.
I'm into that, actually. That's cool.
Yes. And then she shows that it was like how that role at that time period was like putting women in the system of like food production, like another cog in the machine, basically, of like things that needed to happen rather than allowing them to have their own roles. It's super cool. Anyway, definitely check that out.
Yeah, no, as like you're talking, I'm pulling up the Google Doc. So if anyone's watching and it looks like I'm being rude and not paying attention, I'm looking at the pictures. Yeah. Yes. Which you should too. Pull up another tab and while you listen and look up what we're showing you.
I'm all for that. It's always hard with the physical art.
I know that's like, the one when we talk about visual art, it's very hard to properly put it into words.
Yeah. But I'm like, let me try and explain this to you.
Yeah, literally.
This other one's really cool too. It's Tracy Emin's My Bed from 1998. I love the story behind this. Basically, she had a really long bedridden bender, is what she called it, following a bad breakup. And then it's the equivalent of a depression bed. People talk about, oh, my depression apartment. I came out of depression and looked around and went, oh, shoot.
Yeah.
And this was basically what happened with her bed. She finally left the sheets and then looked, and there was like crumpled tissues, there was period stained clothing, there were cigarettes, empty vodka bottles, a pregnancy test, lubricant, condoms, like all surrounding her bed, and was like, huh, it's a work of art.
Slay. I love it.
Yep. So she literally hauled her bed to an art exhibit and set everything up how she had it. And
I was thinking she like recreated it or did a sculpture based on that. That's okay.
Yeah, it was her bed. And it was just this, I don't know, like really relatable in a way that like you don't feel like it should be, especially during the time like 1998 when people were still a little bit like, oh, don't talk about sex or like other things like that. And so it was very hard for people looking at it. They're like, oh, this is so crazy. Like, it was very controversial. They're like, oh, she has vodka and pregnancy tests and condoms and
totally
period stained clothing, like all in the same place. Like, this is so, it's too much. But one thing I liked is that they said that it is a powerful symbolism. What's interesting is that the bed is a stage for birth, depressive isolation, and death. It's a powerful symbolism found in literature and art in the work of Munch and Blake, for example. But her bed, however, offers a particularly feminine angle on those motifs. Her work elevates the anxieties of life as a woman to a monumental status.
I like that.
That's so true, because not only was she shoving it to society, being like, here's my bed.
Yeah.
Go ahead and judge me if you want for my depression episodes and like everything else that's there. But also, everything is so inherently feminine. The period stained clothing, the pregnancy tests, the lube, and the condoms. It's like all these things and anxieties that have to do with womanhood, and especially after a breakup. I just feel like it's so personal. So that was really cool. Okay, the next tenet of feminine rage is a very common one, and I'll talk about it with movies too. So if you find this topic triggering, I'm sorry. I'm not going to go into details, but it will come up a lot. Is very often we talk about it in regards to rape and like rape culture, sexual assault, sexual abuse. Sadly, it seems to be a very common fixture in the feminine experience, which I hate. So a lot of people have raged against it. I, of course, had to talk about Artemisia Gentileschi. Would be ridiculous if I didn't.
Our second episode ever was about her?
Yeah. And she's the reason we're here.
Truly.
So, yeah. So definitely one to pay attention to. But she has two paintings that I brought up in that episode that I feel like fit this. And this one specifically doesn't really, the subject matter isn't entirely about rape, but because of her history and the fact that she made the guy look like her rapist. I feel like it still fits and it's very associated with that. And that's Judith Slaying Holofernes from 1614 to 1620 is what they assume. And it's an amazing painting. Honestly, one of my favorites ever that we've ever talked about. Mm-hmm. It's this portrayal of the biblical story of Judith who decapitates the Assyrian general Holofernes. And one thing that's cool and that we talked about in her episode is that unlike so many other male artists of the past who had done this same story and painted it, she doesn't have Judith leaning back, closing her eyes, tentatively decapitating him. She has her handmaids holding them down and she is just slaying off his head and blood is dripping everywhere. It's gory. But it's also showing that women are capable of things like that, of violence and of revenge and aggression, and also her own experiences with fighting against the patriarch society, especially as an artist in those days, and like having to stand trial against her rapist at a time when couldn't have been easy. It's not easy now, let alone then. So it's just an incredible painting that I feel like really is the pinnacle of feminine rage. Another thing I love is her painting Susanna and the Elders. We talked about that and how the X-rayed version shows that she had to paint over the face of Susanna because of the extreme outrage that she has. And that story is about two men going to rape a young woman named Susanna in the Bible. So anyway, just an incredible artist and I feel like a very good example of feminine rage.
Absolutely. Hall brought her up too in our episode for Monday.
Yeah. It's like the hallmark. Like you think feminine rage and you're like, oh yeah, definitely. This next one is actually an artist I've had on my list forever. I want to talk about her eventually. It just keeps getting pushed back. But Elisabetta Serrani, she has a painting called Timoclea Killing Her Rapist from 1659. And very, very akin to Artemisia's. But she's throwing him down a well. Which I love too, because she literally has him upside down, holding him by the ankles and like shoving him down a well. So it's just like
absolutely
big description of women are capable women.
And he looks so stupid.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
He looks like an idiot. Flailing around and he has a cape on.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And it's from the story of the biography of Alexander the Great. And basically what happened is Alexander invaded Thebes. And then a captain in his army raped Timoclea. And following the assault, he asks where her money is hidden. And she leads him to the garden well. And as he peers into it, she pushes him in and then drops rocks down the well until he dies.
Amazing. Good.
Where did that punishment go for rapists?
Valid.
Finally reinstate it. Upside down and helpless. His feet are flailing in the air. And then she's standing firmly above him. It's very dramatic and wonderful.
Yeah.
But a lot of depictions of this show it in the aftermath of like her standing before Alexander to accept her judgment with her children nearby, or just more in the context of Alexander the Great, whereas Serrani showed it in the moment where she's getting her justice.
Interesting.
Which I think is a way more powerful take from the female perspective. Then being like, oh, kneeling at the feet of Alexander.
What does Alexander the Great have to say about this?
Exactly. Yeah. Another artist I want to talk about in this is Kara Walker. She's actually still going. Yeah, she was born in 1969.
Oh, okay,
but she's been going for a while. And it's her whole subject matter, I think, fits into this really well. So I didn't pick a specific piece. But one thing I really loved, so she does silhouettes. She'll cut out paper. And then of silhouettes on black paper, they're really detailed, though. It does not look like something you could cut.
No.
And then uses them to create scenes and motifs. And it's cool because she manages to get so much detail, even though it's a silhouette. It's crazy. They're really cool. And she has a bunch of them. But from her artist statement, she said, I am tired. Tired of standing up, being counted. Tired of having a voice, or worse, being a role model. So expressing the fatigue. And that's a main part of her artist statements. She is fed up and she's going to let you know. Mm-hmm. And her subject matter that she frequently covers is violence and unsettling scenes from the antebellum South. So it's showing like that intersection of racial discrimination as well as gender discrimination.
Yeah.
And like historical trauma. And then like ongoing rage against the backdrop of slavery and the legacy of that. I can't even imagine knowing that was done and having to deal with aftermaths of that for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And still feeling so much rage about it. And she actually was very inspired by Gone with the Wind, which I thought was fun, because she said it was the first time that she noticed that she wanted to be the heroine and yet kill the heroine at the same time.
I have ranted about how much I hate Scarlett.
Yep.
My least favorite person.
Yeah. So I thought that was really cool that she's talking about, like, you want to be the hero of the story, but then at the same time, she was like, I wanted to kill the hero of the story.
I did too. Yeah. I did too. My nemesis.
I know, right? So I thought that was really cool. And especially because it took place during that time period as well. So it's like a very fitting time period.
Yeah.
But she has had a ton of different pieces. There's one where they have a white guy being hung up, like he's being lynched, but with his feet. And then they have a girl gutting him, which people are like, oh, that's horrible. And sadly, that happened in the opposite direction with black men. So it's just not, she flips it on its head and forces the viewer to have to confront things like that. Yeah. Another thing I heard is that she'll frequently show like slave owners and how they would interact with their female slaves.
Ooh, yeah.
And that's why I put her in this category, and kind of the rage and like how you have to move forward from that, even though you shouldn't have to. Things like that. Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah. Incredible artist, and definitely one to look at more of her pieces. Then the next one I have is objectification as like the next tenant, which sadly happens to women all the time and continues to happen. It's like an ongoing thing. We talked about the male and female lens, and I even recently saw a quote that was like, women never exist without the male lens, because even when you're alone, if you've grown up in our society, you catch yourself wondering if you look presentable. You're viewing yourself. The fact that I'll be home alone and sometimes I'll still fix my hair, or you know what I mean? It's like, why? No one's looking. No one cares. No, what does it
you're
matter?
By yourself.
Yeah. And it's because you view yourself through the lens of society, even when you're alone, because of how we've been trained. There's two performance pieces that I think fit this really well. One of them is Yoko Ono's cut piece from 1964. Horrifying. She sat on the stage in a full outfit and had a piece of scissors by her, a pair of scissors, and then told the audience to come up and cut pieces of her clothing off with the scissors. And people went, and then of course they filmed it, and that's the art piece now. People started out with like really small pieces, like they would go up and just chop off like a sleeve or something like that. And then after a couple of people had gone up, someone went up and basically cut off the entire top of her shirt and her bra straps. And then it continued from there to the point where she was extremely exposed, which she thought might happen. It's still shocking. And you can see the look on her face as it continues in the video. And it's just, ugh. But it's just talking about like, vulnerability, objectification, violation of the female body in this quiet rage way where you can see her face being like, are you kidding me? While they continue to cut pieces of her clothes off. Very fitting. And then this one, I learned about this piece probably when I was too young to learn about it, because it has haunted me my entire life. And I keep going to talk about it and keep forgetting. So I knew when we were doing this episode that this is one that I definitely had to talk about. It's Rhythm Zero by Marina Abramović, I think is how you say it, from 1974.
I remember you telling me about this.
Okay. Did I talk about it previously then?
I don't remember like when we even did talk about it. I don't even know if you just told me about it when we were talking.
It might have been. But I even could have mentioned it to you in high school. Like I'm telling you, this piece has haunted me my whole life. I think I learned about it in junior high or like sixth grade even. Like it was early. It's horrifying. So trigger warning, definitely. But okay, so Marina Abramović is performance artist. So very much so like Yoko Ono's piece, she invited the audience to participate. And it was a 6-hour performance art live, like happening in the moment. And it happened in Naples. And basically she had the instructions that she would stand still, and then she had 72 objects laid out on a table. And people from the audience were invited to do whatever they wanted to her for 6 hours with any of the objects on the table. The objects included a rose, feather, perfume, honey, bread, grapes, wine, scissors, a scalpel, nails, a metal bar, a gun, and a bullet.
Oh my, that's the part. Oh yeah, freaks me out.
Like arranging. And I read a thing, someone said that she literally went in thinking I might die and was like okay with it. Because she wanted to see how far people would do something when you dehumanize yourself. And that was the idea. She like didn't react. There's some pictures of her eyes watering, but other than that, she did nothing. She stood there and took it the entire time. And sadly, I feel like it's such a reflection of humanity because it's just, At first, people were gentle. They moved her arms. They touched her gently. They turned her around. And then as more viewers came in, things got rougher. Like mob mentality, literally. I feel like this proves it. In hour one, someone turned her around. By hour two, literally 2 hours, someone had used the knife to cut her.
Oh my, yeah, that's insane.
The third hour, people cut up her clothes with razor blades. She literally had no clothes left. And they did it with razor blades. So she was bleeding. At some point later, her skin was sliced and she started bleeding with the razor blades. And then in those last hours, someone placed the loaded gun in her hand, aimed at herself, and put her finger on the trigger.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's so scary.
And everyone was standing there watching it.
And that's the, like, you would think that I'm hoping someone would have been like, whoa, okay, that's too far. Let's stop that then.
And people did. They eventually started an argument and it didn't lead to it. But literally whoever did that was ready to have her shoot herself.
Was like, let's see if she does it.
Yeah. And it's you're forcing her to do it.
Yeah.
Just ridiculous. At the end of the 6 hours, this is the part that makes me the most sick. Mm-hmm. At the end of the 6 hours, she stood up and walked towards them and they ran.
Whoa. That's powerful.
Yeah.
Honestly.
It was like they were treating her like an object, and the moment they had to consider her human again, they couldn't confront what they had done. They couldn't
confront it.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of things connect with that, but especially just there's so many people nowadays that are preaching women are objects. And young men are listening. Yeah. There's so much glorification of Andrew Tate and everything like that. And they're literally saying, like, women. I heard a quote from Andrew Tate today. He said, women are too stupid to understand taxes. I'm like, oh, they're so hard. What the heck? And so it's just like when you treat people like objects, you dehumanize them. And it leads to catastrophic events. Absolutely. You can't do that. People are people. They are not objects. Anyway, haunted continually.
I remember you telling me about that. I don't remember when. Don't even remember if it was podcast related, but it's very freaky.
Yeah, it could have been on the podcast. I don't know. I don't remember talking about it. But
I don't know when we did, but still.
There's one other one, too, that I want to talk about with objectification. It's Carrie Mae Weems, and it's a photo series that's called From Here, I Saw What Happened and I Cried. Mm-hmm. It's from 1995 to 1996. And what she did is she actually took pictures from, once again, the antebellum era. But it was this photographer, Joseph T. Zeely, in 1950. He was commissioned by a Harvard scientist. And they were basically trying to support racist theories about the inferiority of Black people. Oh. And so they had them come in and basically took pictures of them like they were specimens in a lab. Like they made them sit like naked or half naked. They like moved them around. Like super weird and creepy, like not human portraits. Like,
yeah,
it was super weird. And so she took those images and then put them in frames and then etched on the glass different quotes, which is really incredible. And then on either side, she has images of a royal Manjibutu woman witnessing the narrative. And it's just showing that like she enlarged some of them, she cropped them, she tinted them. Like all sorts of different things. They're all in a circular mat to show that it was like a lens that took this and put it in that situation. And then it was just, she said, I wanted to intervene in that by giving a voice to the subject that historically has no voice. Because that's such a good point. Like these people had no say in what was happening to them and them having to participate in this weird stereotypical harmful experiment.
Yeah.
And so it's showing like that rage against the racial injustice and especially like the specific impact on Black women that I had at the time of being treated like an anthropological study instead of a human. Yeah. Super messed up. But I think it's a really cool way that she was able to take like those harmful photographs and turn them into a retrospective on it. And then the last one is the last like subcategory for art is against representation or oppression, which is definitely something to rage against. So this is just shedding more light on ways that women are involved in things that we don't talk about. The first one is Faith Ringgold's For the Women's House from 1971. I want to read more about this piece. I think it's so cool. She went to the Women's House of Detention in New York City, like literally like a women's prison. And it was after she had been awarded like a grant by the New York State Council on the Arts to produce a work for a public institution in New York City. So she's okay, I'll go to the prison. And she talked to them about like different ways that women were not represented, non-traditional roles and occupations, talking to them about things that they would never be able to do or participate in through like all these interviews. And then it has these strong female figures engaged in all of these diverse professions and activities to kind of show the stereotypes and limitations placed on women.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. The whole process of it and everything, I'm like, so cool. So she has women playing sports.
I pulled it up. One's acting as a police officer. One's even just a bus driver.
A construction worker.
Yeah.
Oh, I think one's like a scientist. Different things like women weren't allowed to do and just shedding light on that. I think it's so cool. Another one we've definitely talked about before, so I won't spend forever on it, but it's Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party in 1979. If you don't know, it's just like this huge installation. It's a triangle table with 39 place settings, and each of them are dedicated to a mythical or historically famous woman. It's really cool. It was just shedding light on female figures throughout history and how we erase them from women's achievements, literally why we are here doing what we do. It's really cool. It's incredibly famous. I love the place settings and how individual and custom they all are. So definitely go look it up and see some pictures. It's very cool. Also talked about actually in school, which is the only one I think I've talked about so far that is.
Yeah, I think so.
Besides maybe Rhythm Zero, but we didn't talk about it in college. I learned about it.
I wouldn't have known. Yeah. I only know of it because of you. Mm-hmm. So
this other one is really cool too. It's Ana Mendieta. And it's the Silhouetta series. It took place from 1973 to 1980. Mm-hmm. This is so cool. She would go to natural landscapes, create a silhouette of her body within this place, and then photograph them.
Oh, I'm obsessed.
Yes. And there's so many. There's literally so many.
Googling
and
it was right now.
Yes. And it's showing displacement of Native women, of violence against women, the erasure of female identity, because also, something that they pointed out is the fact that all of these silhouettes disappear after she leaves. The photograph is the only record that they were there because they're made out of natural elements. Like she's doing it in the sand and then the tide comes in and washes it away.
Yeah.
She does it with natural things and eventually they get trampled over. Animals come and eat them. And so it's just showing that people exist and are there and they're a part of the natural landscape. And then things destroy them and we don't have any record of it.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I'm flipping through these pictures. These are stunning.
Yes, they're so cool. I think she's done more than 200, I think is what it said.
Oh, whoa, that's amazing.
And it was mainly in Iowa and Mexico where she made them. That's she cool. also was playing off the idea of Mother Earth, the fact that we literally call our planet a mother. Mm-hmm. And we could get on a whole climate change thing of like, wow. Do we need to devalue women so much that we treat our earth like crap too?
You know what? That's valid.
Her personal history, she was exiled from Cuba at a very young age. And so she was very overwhelmed from a very young age by the feeling of having been cast from the womb or like from your home area and trying to find a way to return to the maternal source of the earth and become one with it. So very cool. This is another one we talked about in our feminist art episode. So once again, won't do it at 10. We did talk about this one in graphic design history. So kudos to graphic design history.
There we go. One thing's caught up.
Yep. It's Barbara Kruger's Your Body is a Battleground, 1989. It's a photographic silkscreen on vinyl, and it was created for the Women's March on Washington in support of reproductive freedom. Very cool. Fitting. It was just, it's explaining the fact that women's rights and autonomy don't belong to them. People are going to fight a war over your body and you don't even get to participate in it. And just that critique of societal and political battles over women's bodies and rights. Oh, we're going to pass laws about your body.
Here it is.
Relevant. Body is a battleground. Very fitting. Are we ready for movies?
Ah, yes. There's all of our art pieces. Wow. Yes. So many great ones to go look and check out.
Definitely. So. And there's so many more. I literally could not dive into all of them, especially more modern ones too that are taking place. And there's so much going on with, mm-hmm. I think performance art and installation arts are where it shines
yeah.
a lot. And paintings, I feel, are a little bit harder. And Hall talked about this, how people want to create more digestible
yeah.
things mm-hmm. because a painting is something you buy and hang in your house. So it needs yes. to be like a little more commercial or marketable from mm-hmm. people's opinions. Whereas like an installation or a performance piece is something that exists just for the sake of existing, which
true.
Is kind of cool. I feel like there's a lot more space in there for
that
rage.
I'm ready to talk about some movies though.
Okay. Good, because I have watched, I think, every single one of these that I'm going to cover.
Yeah,
I've been studying.
You've been ready.
I have. I've watched so many, and I didn't include all the ones I watched. There were too many to do that. The first one, once again, I wanted to talk about rape culture again. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of rape revenge movies. I actually watched a really horrific one that I don't think I would recommend, but I felt like it was in so many things that I watched it. It's I Spit on Your Grave.
Oh, I've never even heard of that.
Terrifying. Do not recommend.
Okay, cool.
Nightmares for Days. It's so bad. I watched the remake, which is apparently better than the original, but there is a documentary on how it's based on a true story.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And I watched part of the documentary. I don't think I've finished it because I was like, oh, this is too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so terrifying. Even if you just read the premise, you'll understand like why I'm horrified.
Freaking out about it? Yeah.
Yes. So bad. And based on true stories. That's super fun. But there's obviously a lot of movies about this. The three that I picked are Teeth, which I talked about briefly
yes.
from 2008. Yes. It's directed by Mitchell Lichtenstein and it stars Jess Wexler. Would I recommend this movie? No, probably not. Am I glad I watched it? Yes.
I get it.
Yep. Yeah. The premise is that Dawn, who is played by Jess Wexler, is an active member of her high school chastity club. And then she meets this guy, Toby, and they end up in this situation and their things are getting heated. And then she tries to back out in the middle of it and he doesn't let her.
Ah.
Then we find out that she is a living example of this myth that has existed forever. Mm-hmm. It's like a real myth called vagina dentata, where it's basically like her vagina has teeth. So
it
chomps him and he bleeds out and dies off camera, luckily. But they do find his body later. Yeah, so she's horrified, as one would be, because she doesn't understand what happens. So then she goes to a gynecologist to figure out what's going on. And surprise, he's also a creep. So he starts doing things against her. And she chomps off his fingers.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good
so then she like freaks out and runs off and she's like, crap, something's wrong with me. And she's like trying to tell one of her, this guy that's been pursuing her forever. She's like trying to tell him about it, even though he's a weirdo. And he's like, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. And so he is all romantic with her and they have consensual sex and everything's fine. But then the next day he answers a phone call when they're having sex again and basically starts bragging to his friend about how he was able to get her even though they said he couldn't. Literally being like, you said it would be impossible and I'm having sex with her right now. Like being a total.
Yeah.
And of course, in that moment.
It chomps.
It chomps. And
oh my God.
Yes, a lot of things happen. Her stepbrother ends up like being the reason that her mom passes away. Oh, I should have said spoiler alerts for all of these. Like, I've not been keeping them.
Fair.
Yeah. So like her stepbrother ends up being the reason her mom passes away. And it turns out that he's had like this weird crush on her their whole lives, even though they grew up as basically siblings. Mm-hmm. And so she takes revenge on him by like seducing him. And then, you know, and then she runs away from home because she doesn't want to get arrested and hitchhikes. And then as she goes to leave the car, the guy that she hitchhikes with locks the doors and basically says, pay up.
Ah,
yeah. And she is okay and turns and looks at the camera and smiles like, well, he's gonna get what's coming to him. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And I feel like it's just a depiction of the fact that no matter where she went for like help, like her boyfriend mm-hmm. that she was in love with, he tried to rape her. Like her gynecologist tried to.
Yeah.
And then it's her stepbrother, like the guy at the end, like no matter what she did, someone was always trying to take advantage of her mm-hmm. and how she had a way to fight back about that. But so many women don't. They yeah. don't have that opportunity and they don't have that kind of revenge that they're able to get or that way that they can fight back against it. So it's a very important movie in a way that I feel like it shows how bleak the female experience can be at times. Mm-hmm. But oh my gosh, it was horrific.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of gory and gross. Yeah. Anyway. That's Teeth. The next one is so good. I would recommend this movie to absolutely everyone.
Yeah, it's heavy.
It's heavy, but it's incredible, mm-hmm. but so heavy. It's Promising Young Woman, came out in 2020, directed by Emerald Fennell, stars Carey Mulligan. And basically the main character, Cassie, has like a double life. Like she goes out at night, dresses provocatively in different ways, and basically has men take her home and then pretends to be inebriated to the point where they're going to take advantage of her and rape her. And then she shows them that she's completely sober and confronts them mm-hmm. and basically yells at them and then says that she'll hunt him down if they ever do it again and leaves. And you find out that her best friend committed suicide because she had been at a party, but I think multiple people, right?
Or at least people were complicit.
Yeah. It. People watched it happen and were like fine with it. And that this is how she's trying to
get revenge in a way?
Yeah. Or, get yeah. revenge or make it right. That in mm-hmm. some way she feels guilty for what happened because she wasn't there. She couldn't protect her. And yeah. so she's trying to right the wrongs of everything that's happened. And major spoiler alert, because if you want to watch this movie, pause, go watch, and then come back, because I don't want to ruin it.
It doesn't end well.
No. She basically finds out that her boyfriend was one of the people who was complicit in the whole thing, and that he is still friends with the guys who mm-hmm. did it. And she gets their information and then crashes one of the guy's bachelor parties, pretending to mm-hmm. be like a prostitute. And basically straps him down and is going to not kill him, right? She was just gonna inject him with
I don't know exactly what was gonna happen. I can't remember either.
It's been a little while. She was just gonna get like revenge because he was the main guy behind it, and he fights back enough to kill her. And then his bachelor party group, or at least his best man and him, dispose of her body. But she was like expecting it to happen, and so she set up like all these fail safes, and the police come and arrest him.
Yep.
And she gets revenge for her friend's death with her own.
I feel like I've seen the way that the movie has maybe been criticized of like, why? I don't know. But unfortunately, it's maybe just a reality. I don't know. I did not have a great experience in that movie because I got in my car and sobbed.
I feel like that would be a normal reaction.
Yeah,
I looked at it as that she couldn't get him arrested for her friend's sexual assault. Mm. So, like, the way that her twisted mind, like, she's not mentally okay in this movie. I don't think there's anything about this that's like, this is rational, is the fact that she felt like the only way that she could get revenge for what happened to her friend was to get mm-hmm. him arrested for her murder.
True.
Yeah. So I think it's just showing, like, the plight of sexual assault victims. Now there's mm-hmm. not really justice. Beautiful movie. A horrifying subject.
Yeah.
The last one in this vein, and then, yeah, we'll move on from this, is Last Night in Soho, 2021, directed by Edgar Wright, starring Thomasin McKenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy. You've seen this one too, right?
Mm-hmm. I like this one.
Yeah. This one's good. It's definitely a horror movie.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But what happens is that Thomasin McKenzie is like this aspiring fashion designer. She moves to school, ends up getting like a room off campus, and then finds out that at night she is able to enter the 1960s and mirror the life of this dazzling wannabe singer during that time. Mm-hmm. And it's in Soho in the 1960s. And then she slowly sees like the glamour kind of fade away and realize like the reality of trying to rise to fame. And she sees this girl who just wants to be, who's played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who just wants to be a singer, eventually have to like, she's forced into prostitution. Mm-hmm. And there's like all these people that are visiting her bedroom all the time. And then like her boyfriend's super abusive and he like pulls a knife on her. Anyway, she ends up being haunted by it because she can't get sleep, because every time she goes to bed, she's back in Soho in the 1960s, and it starts interfering with her daily life until she unravels the mystery that like her landlady is actually the older version of Anya Taylor-Joy, and all of those men, she murdered them in that room. Mm-hmm.
That she lives in.
Yeah. Yes, for raping her and... because that's what that form of prostitution was. Like, it was not consensual. She had murdered all of them, and then their ghosts were there. And one thing I really loved is that there's that moment where the lady's coming after her and the ghosts of all the men are surrounding her. And you have Thomasin McKenzie sitting there by the phone, and she's about to call the police for help. And all of the ghosts are like, call, call, call. And then she looks at all of them and she's like, no. And hangs up. And it was one of those moments where she's like, I'm not siding with you. Like, I saw what you did to her. Like, you deserved every single moment of what happened to you. So, yeah, it's a little more empowering in some ways. She lives. She's able to move forward with it.
This one at least has a happier ending.
Yes. So. And, yeah, she's, like, able to help her get justice and not let things continue in the same. It's very good. But also just the reality of stardom. That industry in the past.
Yeah, I like that movie. That.
Now we have objectification. The first one's Black Swan, 2010, directed by Darren, I'm going to say his name wrong, Aronofsky, stars Natalie Portman.
This one is very good.
It's a very good and puzzling. I finished it and I was like, I got to think about this for a while.
Totally.
But it's a ballerina who is like ruled by her passion for dance. And then they decide to replace the prima ballerina and the company with her for the opening production of Salt Lake. Swan Lake. Wow. I live in Utah. Swan Lake. And throughout the process, she's having a really hard time tapping into like the black swan character and can like only portray the innocence of the white swan. And then through all of it, she comes into this dark side of herself and is able to like mature and move forward and realize her sexuality and move on from the childish role that she has in her mother's home and kind of move past what she was like always expected to be, like the perfect little pretty ballerina, and be herself finally that she'd been fighting against for so long. That's at least what I got out of it.
I very much think that whole I don't know if it's like the cost of perfectionism and artistry. Of like, how far are you willing to go? Because like, she was like, the more obsessed she was with perfection, the more her downward spiral went.
Oh, interesting. And
so I took that more. And like, that's what in the end, spoiler alert, she's so devoted to her role in a way that she becomes the swan so much that she kills herself for the sake of perfection. Mm-hmm. And in the end, she's like, see, I was perfect. But it's, you can't be perfect because you are like, there's no way for you to do that role perfectly.
Yeah.
So it's almost, I took it more of a cautionary tale against perfectionism.
Interesting.
And I think granted, there's like the different layers of her sexuality and her doing what, and then, like, I think that's like the things that she wrestles with is like, how do I, the bad girl, the good girl, who my mom is, but, and breaking free from that. And I don't know. I saw
a video where someone compared the blood at the end to finally getting her period. So kind of being like, oh, she finally matured. So not really that she died. And apparently Natalie Portman said that she didn't for sure die in the last scene. It was meant to be open-ended.
That's true. I wondered if she actually did end up, I couldn't remember if that was obvious.
I think the beauty of this movie is that there's a million different directions that you can take it. It's crazy,
genuinely. I loved that when I finally watched it, because I watched it like last December, very recently. And it's like an older movie.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I was like, crazy.
I think it's good. But yeah, I put it in this one just because of the whole, her room was very childish. And then you see she kinda, like, grows up.
Yeah, I think
that's
like an interesting way, especially, but it's so complex, their relationship with the mother, which I think is like also just an ongoing theme in like woman-led media, is like the relationship between a mother and a daughter.
Yes.
Very interesting, because the mother like had dash dreams as a dancer, and so she would project a lot onto the daughter, and I thought that
was
interesting.
And treat her like a child, even though she was like probably, what, like a at least 22-year-old woman.
Yeah,
she cut her nails for her and was constantly, oh, I'll tuck you in, or like all these things, like locking her in her room, like all sorts of weird stuff. So it was like trying to force her not to grow up in a way.
Totally.
I don't know. Incredible movie. You'll have to watch it and let us know what you think, everyone. So I'm curious. The next one we've talked about as well, and is
we have a whole episode on it.
Yes. Jennifer's Body from 2009, directed by Karen Kusama, starring Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried. So good. I love this movie.
I love this
The
movie
first
too.
Time I watched it, I was like, I don't think I understood it like fully, completely. But the more I watch it, the more I'm like, oh yeah, this is so good. Basically, a demon takes possession of Megan Fox as Jennifer, and then she has to eat guys in order to stay alive, basically. And like young and healthy and everything. There's so much that goes into it. Like I said, we have a whole episode about it. But what I think is like really cool about this one is I feel like it definitely shows like the objectification of like Jennifer was forced to grow up and like use her body to her advantage even before all of this happened. And then the people thinking that she was a virgin is the reason that this ended up happening to her, and like people taking advantage of her and not really treating her as a person, but more of a way to get ahead. And then even, I know the high school boys are innocent, but the way that they're like so ready to be like, okay, Jennifer, I'll go anywhere with you because you're like a pretty girl.
Yeah.
It's just, it's showing that they don't really view her as like a danger or a threat or like a human capable of things beyond that, because they're not worried in the least. Like that one guy walks directly into an abandoned house full of candles. And straight up to her before he's like, oh, maybe this is a little sketchy.
Yeah.
Would a girl even walk in the door if you ended up in a bad neighborhood with an abandoned house and a guy was inside?
Absolutely.
I'd be like,
not.
See ya.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that's a really good one as well. And then this other one I watched recently, I wasn't even planning on putting this on the list. And then I realized it actually fits so perfectly with like the objectification part. This one's called The Neon Demon 2016. Hmm. Directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, and it stars Elle Fanning. First off, it is beautiful. This movie is gorgeously shot, but the whole idea behind it is that she wants to, the main character, Jessie, played by Elle Fanning, she moves to LA and she wants to launch a career as a model, and she's only 16. Mm-hmm. And sadly, that's the age when you start modeling in high fashion. Mm-hmm. And so they like tell her that she has the qualities to become like a top star. So she starts getting booked. And she like becomes the darling of the agency. But then there's like these ruthless older models that are like mad about it. Mm-hmm. And then she's also staying in this creepy motel and weird stuff starts happening there. And then this photographer gets obsessed with her. And so that ends up being like a whole thing. And then eventually you find out that the three older models are like vampires. And they end up eating her at the end in order to like stay young during a full moon situation so that they can absorb her body and her beauty. Very weird. But it has that objectification of her and like how everyone treats her, to the point that even the women in the industry were so ready to cut her down so that they didn't have to. And that's the idea. They said the neon demon is like LA. It just sucks people in. It's the real vampire. Sucks people in and then sucks them up and destroys them. And that she's so young and it happens so quick just because she's pretty.
Yes.
So that's that one. The next one is Betrayal. And we have a whole episode on this too, so I'm not going to dive too much. But Gone Girl is a super big one. The character is obviously not normal psychologically. I think definitely a sociopath, if not a psychopath. But the whole thing that spurs it is the fact that he cheats on her. And so this is her own little revenge story in a way of, this is what you get because you betrayed
me. This is
me.
How she responds to it.
Yep.
Yep.
Amazing, amazing, amazing movie. This other one I saw recently too, Ready or Not, 2019. Mm-hmm.
This one's fun.
Yeah. Directed by Tyler Gillette and Matt Bentolini Open, and it stars Samara Weaving. I loved the concept behind this one because what on earth?
Yeah.
So crazy. So the main character, Grace, is so happy because she marries the man of her dreams at his family's luxurious estate, and then finds out that there's like this tradition where they have to play a game and they draw a card or something, right? I think it is, to decide what game you'll play. And then apparently she picks the one game that
where she
has,
could be murdered.
Yes. Like all of the rest of them are literally just regular board games or card games. But this one is a hide and seek. And the idea is she has to hide from midnight until dawn while her new in-laws hunt her down with guns, crossbows, and other weapons and tries to survive. And the idea behind it is that she won't make it through. Either they have to kill her or they'll all die. Come dawn, which... What on earth?
Some deal with the devil
situation. Like, yeah, deal with the devil for fame and money and fortune or something. But my favorite Lemon Rage moment of it all is that her fiance like ends up turning on her. Like he's trying to help her escape in the beginning. And then he's actually, I believe that this is true. I think we'll die if we don't kill you. So he turns on her and starts like trying to help his relatives kill her. And she just freaks out on him. And she makes it through the whole night. And then all of them end up like blowing up. So it was like true all along.
Yep.
But then she like walks out and she's sitting on the front steps like smoking a cigarette. And the police officer goes up to her and he's like, are you okay? And I don't even remember what she says.
Yeah, but it's a pretty good moment.
Oh,
it's a good
moment. Says in-laws. She's in-laws.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, but I think it's so good. They underestimate her. They don't expect her to do so good. But she grew up really poor. And so she's super scrappy. And survives the whole thing.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. And I think because she's married to him, I assume she'd probably be the one to get everything too.
She gets the, I think that's how the movie ends.
Because there's no one left. So very good one on betrayal as well. And then Midsommar 2019. So good.
Yeah, that one's freaky.
Yep. Directed by Ari Aster, starring Florence Pugh. I feel like this is, it's so creepy, but it's like daylight the entire time, which in some ways like makes it more unnerving. But like in other ways, I feel like makes it easier to watch than other.
One of the most unsettling movies I have ever seen.
Yes.
I will say.
So it's this couple. One of them is dealing, the girl, Florence Pugh, she's dealing with grief. They go to Sweden to visit their friend's rural hometown for their Midsummer festival. Mm-hmm. And then it quickly, they realize that they're in a pagan cult.
Yep. And crazy ensues.
Yeah. Her boyfriend, who's crappy the whole time,
he's not a good boyfriend.
No, he's the worst. Like, her parents die and he, like, get over it, basically. And he's planning on breaking up with her, but then she ends up going on the trip too. And so he's, oh, I guess I'll wait till after. Mm-hmm. He's so scummy. But he cheats on her with a girl from the cult and she, like, sobs. And then eventually, like, all of them end up dying while she gets crowned.
Like spring queen?
The spring queen, and just sits there and stares at them while they burn.
Burn. Yeah. It's a whoof.
Yeah. But the look on her face, feminine rage right then and there.
Yeah.
So good.
Midsommar, man. Florence Pugh. That's the first time I think I saw her and I was like, oh, that lady can act.
I gotta say, I think the queens of the feminine rage era and aesthetic are definitely Anya Taylor-Joy and Florence Pugh.
Yeah, that is so true.
Yep. I feel like they find a way to put it in every role that they're in.
Yep.
And I know Anya Taylor-Joy is very specific about the fact that she really likes to highlight those moments and add it in. So it's really cool. Like,
yeah, it is cool.
Yes. The last one we actually talked about a little bit too, not these specific movies, but like the concept of it. Oh, with like teen angst or like the fact that we don't allow teen girls to be mad. We give teen boys so many outlets for their anger and then we don't give any to teen girls. And that leads to things like Mean Girls.
Yeah.
And like all of those stereotypical mean girl associations with teenage girls in high school. And it's because they don't have outlets for their emotions. Mm-hmm. So that's what this last one is. And the first one I wanted to bring up is The Wilds, which is a TV series.
Oh.
But haven't you seen this? Oh, I thought you had. No. Yeah, it's 2020 to 2022. It's created by Sarah Stryker. It has like a million different directors. Okay. And then three of the main stars for at least the first season are Rachel Griffiths, Sophia Ali, and Shannon Barry. Mm. This whole thing is basically, I've never read the book, but I'm assuming it's like Lord of the Flies premise. Teenagers stranded on an island have to create their own society, but with girls first. The second season, they introduced boys. It got some backlash because they made the boy one look so bad and the girls like made it through for the most part. I don't feel like it's that crazy to assume that's what actually would happen, though. And that's nothing against men. I just think that there was just some things that, you know, I feel like women can kind of gather together a little bit quicker than
a bunch of teenage boys.
Yeah. So basically what happens is that this group of teenage girls from different backgrounds, like completely different backgrounds, like super religious, in the system, like all sorts of different stuff. They're on an airplane and they think that they're going to this like women's empowerment retreat for this program called the Dawn of Eve. And then they crash into the ocean while en route and the pilot is supposedly gone. And so it's just the girls, like the flight attendants are gone. Just the girls survive. And so they find themselves stranded on the deserted island. And then you realize throughout the series that they're subjects of a social experiment. Their parents don't know that this is happening either. So it's like super unethical.
Oh, interesting.
But this plane crash was staged and orchestrated by the head of the Dawn of Eve program. You come to find out they like didn't actually crash the plane, really. They like drugged them on the plane and then landed it and then basically threw them in the ocean with a plane crashed to make them assume that.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Because then so many horrible things happen. There's like a plant supposedly that was supposed to help facilitate things to make sure nothing got too crazy. And she was like trained with CPR and stuff. She dies like right off the bat. So they're like, crap, we need to end this. And then the main lady is, no, we can't. This is a part of it. So they keep the experiment ongoing. It's horrifying. But it's so good. There's like flashback scenes about their lives before the crash. There's flash forward scenes where you realize that they've been rescued and they're like in an underground bunker and they're being interviewed by these two guys that are claiming to be FBI agents about their supposed rescue and like the whole experience and everything. So you get a sense of what happened in a way and what didn't. And then the second season introduces a group of teenage boys and they repeat the experiment with boys. And then the same thing with them being like questioned, their past. And then the girls are still being held in the bunker and begin to discover the truth behind their situation and attempt to reach the boys to let them know what's going on.
Oh.
I didn't watch the second season. It got really bad really fast in a way that the girls' ones didn't. Yeah. Like surprisingly, the girls' season, no sexual assault. The all boys season, sexual assault. Yeah. So I didn't watch that one, but just the season one alone, I feel like it was a really good describer of what teenage girls are going through and like their different emotions and how there's still like a bond there, even though there's a lot of hatred in a lot of ways too. It's really good. Highly recommend. At least the first season. The next one is probably one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen. Bottoms. It came out.
I haven't seen it, but I wanted to watch it. Yeah.
It's so weird. It was directed by Emma Siegelman and stars Rachel Sennett, Ayo Edebiri, Ruby Cruz, and Havana Rose Liu. This movie is so strange. It's gory, first off. If you have a weak stomach, maybe don't watch. It's a lot. But basically what happens is these two friends, PJ and Josie, are both queer. And they have crushes on the two cheerleaders, like the two most popular cheerleaders. And they're super unpopular and they just want to be friends with them or like date them or anything. And they end up having this like chance encounter with one of them where her boyfriend's like being a dick. And then they like rescue her from it because he's getting aggressive. And then they accidentally end up like barely bumping him with their car. But he like pretends he's super injured and then starts spreading all these rumors that they like beat him up. And it was because that they had been in juvie over the summer. And so they start getting like all this street cred for being juvie kids. And they're like, great, we're going to use this because in order not to get expelled, they tell their principal that it was a part of a female feminist self-defense club and that they were just like practicing and he misunderstood. So they form a fight club for the girls of the school where they literally go and beat each other up after school in order to learn how to fight.
Excellent.
Yes. And it goes really well. They actually get like a huge group of people and they're learning things and they have an advisor who ends up teaching about like feminist history in his history class because he's so empowered by all of it and everything.
Amazing.
Yep. But then everything comes to light at the end of the big football game, of course. And so they're all mad at him. But then they find out that the rival football team is trying to kill the head football player. And so they like go to bat for him and basically beat up all the football players on the field. And then the bomb goes off. It's insane. So anyway, but I feel like it shows that like they didn't have a channel for their rage and that was like a good outlet for them. Mm-hmm. I'm not advocating that people go and join a fight club and get punched in the face after school. But I think it's showing the problem that like girls don't have an outlet. The boys have football. They can go. They can tackle each other to the ground, push each other around.
There's not an equivalent of that.
And then the last one is like the crowning beautiful movie of teen feminine rage. Love it. 10 Things I Hate About You, 1999.
So good.
Directed by Gil Junger, starring Julia Stiles, the queen. My favorite quote from that movie is the one where they're like, she's into feminist prose. What is it? Oh, she likes Thai food, feminist prose, and angry girl music of the indie rock persuasion. I'm like, yes, me too. Thai food, feminist prose, and angry girl music of the indie rock persuasion.
What else does a girl need?
That and Heath Ledger. We're set. It's so good. If you haven't seen it, it's based on Taming of the Shrew by Shakespeare with an extremely feminist take that I love, where they have Kat Stratford, played by Julia Stiles, who's like this really beautiful, smart, but also quite abrasive teenage girl. And you can tell she just has so much anger in her and she's not afraid to show it. She has like these quick comebacks and everything. And then her younger sister, Bianca, wants to date, but she can't do it until Kat does. So one of the guys that has a crush on Bianca basically hires the bad boy of the school to date Kat, so that he can date Bianca.
Yeah.
But then you come to find out that Kat was taken advantage of her first year and things happened. And that's why she's so angry. And there's just so much there that she's dealing with that she doesn't know how to deal with. And that's why she reacts the way she does. And that she's actually like a super sensitive person. Mm-hmm. And the same with the bad boy boyfriend, Patrick or Heath Ledger, that he has this whole story and like things that have happened to him. And like people just assume that he's like an angry bad boy who'll chop your fingers off, when actually he's a romantic and is like super nice to her and takes care of her and doesn't take advantage of her in any way. And then they fall in love because it's cute because
it's a perfect chick flick.
It's so good. It's probably one of my top movies of all time. But I think it definitely shows that same thing, like the teen angst, like anger behind it. It also has some really great Riot Girl references.
Yes
And Shakespeare, like, so good.
So many amazing things that are getting all tied up together there.
Yep. So that's the overview of everything. Obviously, like I said, there's
always so much more.
Yeah. But I feel like if you wanted a place to start out with for movies and works of art to look into about feminine rage, I feel like this is a good place to start.
Totally. And next week, I get to tackle books and music.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that as well.
I am too. I'm really excited. I know we've been working on a playlist, so I'm excited to hear some of the stories behind these songs. Because
I know.
Yeah.
I have many, many, many. Yeah. I'm also struggling. Especially with songs. I'm like, we literally have a playlist of 50 plus songs. So we'll see which ones make the cut.
I know. I think I ended up doing 4 different subtitles and then 3 per each. If that helps, I ended up just over an hour.
It's true. We stayed under an hour and a half almost. Barely.
I tried, okay?
No, it's so a lot. Hard. It is so much that we could do.
It was so hard to cut it down.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for joining us for our continuation of Muse-ness and Marsh Madness. Definitely come back next week. And reminder that we have our merch available at our website, just morethanmusepodcast.com. Mm-hmm. It's available for the rest of March. So if you want it, you got 2 weeks left. So
yes. And it's so cute, you guys. Definitely check it out. Love it. We've got a lot of options for all different price points. So
totally.
And don't forget to subscribe, follow, like, comment, rate, review, and all of the above. And we'll see you next time.
The above. And we'll see you next week with two more episodes.
Bye.
Bye.